This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Playing for Pizza by John Grisham. Read for you by Christopher Evan Welch. Chapter 1. It was a hospital bed. That much appeared certain, though certainty was coming and going. It was narrow and hard, and there were shiny metal railings standing sentry-like along the sides, preventing escape. The sheets were plain and very white. Sanitary. The room was dark, but sunlight was trying to creep around the blinds covering the window. He closed his eyes again. Even that was painful. Then he opened them, and for a long silent minute or so he managed to keep the lids apart and focus on his cloudy little world. He was lying on his back and pinned down by firmly tucked sheets. He noticed a tube dangling to his left, running down to his hand, then disappearing up somewhere behind him. There was a voice in the distance, out in the hallway. Then he made the mistake of trying to move. Just a slight adjustment of the head, and it didn't work. Hot bolts of pain hit his skull and neck, and he groaned loudly. "Rick, are you awake?" The voice was familiar, and quickly a face followed it. Arnie was breathing on him. "Arnie?" he said with a weak, scratchy voice, and then he swallowed. "It's me, Rick. Thank God you're awake." Arnie the agent, always there at the important moments.
"Where am I, Arnie?"
"You're in the hospital, Rick."
"Got that. But why?"
"When did you wake up?" Arnie found a switch, and a light came on beside the bed.
"I don't know, a few minutes ago."
"How do you feel?"
"Like someone crushed my skull."
"Close. You're gonna be fine. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me." How many times had he heard Arnie ask for trust? Truth was, he'd never completely trusted Arnie, and there was no plausible reason to start now. What did Arnie know about traumatic head injuries or whatever mortal wound someone had inflicted? Rick closed his eyes again and breathed deeply.
"What happened?"
he asked softly. Arnie hesitated and ran a hand over his hairless head. He glanced at his watch. 4 p.m. So his client had been knocked out for almost 24 hours. Not long enough, he thought, sadly. "What's the last thing you remember?" Arnie asked as he carefully put both elbows on the bed's railing and leaned forward. After a pause, Rick managed to say,
"I remember Bannister coming at me."
Arnie smacked his lips and said, "No, Rick. That was the second concussion, 2 years ago in Dallas, when you were with the Cowboys." Rick groaned at the memory, and it wasn't pleasant for Arnie either, because his client had been squatting on the sideline looking at a certain cheerleader when the play came his way, and he was squashed, helmetless, by a ton of flying bodies. Dallas cut him 2 weeks later and found another third-string quarterback. "Last year you were in Seattle, Rick, and now you're in Cleveland, the Browns, remember?" Rick remembered and groaned a bit louder.
"What day is it?"
he asked, eyes open now. "Monday. The game was yesterday. Do you recall any of it?" "Not if you're lucky," Arnie wanted to say. "I'll get a nurse. They've been waiting."
"Not yet, Arnie. Talk to me. What happened?"
"You threw a pass, and you got sandwiched. Purcell came on a weak side blitz and took your head off. You never saw him."
"Why was I in the game?"
Now, that was an excellent question, one that was raging on every sports radio show in Cleveland and the upper Midwest. Why was he in the game? Why was he on the team? Where in the hell did he come from?
"Let's talk about it later," Arnie said,
and Rick was too weak to argue. With great reluctance, his wounded brain was stirring slightly, shaking itself from its coma and trying to awaken. The Browns. Browns Stadium on a very cold Sunday afternoon before a record crowd. The playoffs. No, more than that. The AFC title game. The ground was frozen, hard as concrete and just as cold. A nurse was in the room, and Arnie was announcing,
"I think he snapped out of it."
"That's great," she said, without much enthusiasm. "I'll go find a doctor." With even less enthusiasm. Rick watched her leave without moving his head. Arnie was cracking his knuckles and ready to bolt.
"Look, Rick, I need to get going."
"Sure, Arnie. Thanks."
No problem. Look, there's no easy way to say this, so I'll just be blunt. The Browns called this morning, Wacker, and, well, they've released you. It was almost an annual ritual now, this postseason cutting. I'm sorry, Arnie said, but only because he had to say it. Call the other teams, Rick said, and certainly not for the first time. Evidently, I won't have to. They're already calling me. That's great. Not really. They're calling to warn me not to call them. I'm afraid this might be the end of the line, kid. There was no doubt it was the end of the line, but Arnie just couldn't find the candor. Maybe tomorrow. 8 teams in 6 years. Only the Toronto Argonauts dared to sign him for a second season. Every team needed a backup to their backup quarterback, and Rick was perfect for the role. Problems started, though, when he ventured onto the field. Gotta run, Arnie said, glancing at his watch again. And listen, do yourself a favor and keep the television turned off. It's brutal, especially ESPN. He patted his knee and darted from the room. Outside the door, there were two thick security guards sitting in folding chairs, trying to stay awake. Arnie stopped at the nurse's station and spoke to the doctor, who eventually made his way down the hall, past the security guards, and into Rick's room. His bedside manner lacked warmth. A quick check of the basics without much conversation. Neurological work to follow. Just another garden-variety brain concussion. Isn't this the third one? I think so, Rick said. Thought about finding another job? The doctor asked. No. Perhaps you should, the doctor thought, and not just because of your bruised brain. 3 interceptions in 11 minutes should be a clear sign that football is not your calling. 2 nurses appeared quietly and helped with the tests and paperwork. Neither said a word to the patient, though he was an unmarried professional athlete with notable good looks and a hard body. And at that moment, when he needed them, they could not have cared less. As soon as he was alone again, Rick very carefully began looking for the remote. A large television hung from the wall in the corner. He planned to go straight to ESPN and get it over with. Every movement hurt, and not just his head and neck. Something close to a fresh knife wound ached in his lower back. His left elbow, the non-throwing one, throbbed with pain. Sandwiched? He felt like he'd been flattened by a cement truck. The nurse was back, holding a tray with some pills. Where's the remote? Rick asked.
The television's broke.
Arnie pulled the plug, didn't he?
Which plug?
The television.
Who's Arnie?
She asked as she tinkered with a rather large needle.
What's that?
Rick asked, forgetting Arnie for a second.
Vicodin. It'll help you sleep.
I'm tired of sleeping.
Doctor's orders, okay? You need rest and lots of it.
She drained the Vicodin into his IV bag and watched the clear liquids for a moment.
Are you a Browns fan?
Rick asked.
My husband is.
Was he at the game yesterday?
Yes.
How bad was it?
You don't want to know.
When he awoke, Arnie was there again, sitting in a chair beside the bed and reading the Cleveland Post. At the bottom of the front page, Rick could barely make out the headline, Fans Storm Hospital.
What?
Rick said, as forcefully as possible. Arnie snatched the paper down and bolted to his feet.
Are you okay, kid?
Wonderful, Arnie. What day is it?
Tuesday, early Tuesday morning. How do you feel, kid?
Give me that newspaper.
What do you want to know?
What's going on, Arnie?
What do you want to know?
Everything.
Have you watched television?
No. You pulled the plug. Talk to me, Arnie.
Arnie cracked his knuckles, then walked slowly to the window, where he barely opened the blinds.
He peered through them, as if trouble were out there. Yesterday, some hooligans came here and made a scene. Cops handled it well, arrested 12 or so. Just a bunch of thugs. Browns fans.
How many?
Paper said about 20.
Just drunks.
And why did they come here, Arnie?
It's just you and me.
Agent and player, the door's closed. Please fill in the blanks.
They found out you were here. A lot of folks would like to take a shot at you these days. You've had 100 death threats.
Folks are upset. They're even threatening me. Arnie leaned against the wall, a flash of smugness because his life was now worth being threatened.
You still don't remember?
He asked.
No,
Browns are up 17-0 over the Broncos with 11 minutes to go. Zip doesn't come close to describing the ass-kicking. After three quarters, the Broncos have 81 yards in total offense and three, count them, three first downs. Anything? No. Ben Maroon is at quarterback because Nagel pulled a hamstring in the first quarter. I remember that now. With 11 minutes to go, Maroon gets drilled on a late hit. They carry him off. No one's worried because the Browns' defense could stop General Patton in his tanks. You take the field. 3rd and 12, you throw a beautiful pass in the flat to Sweeney, who, of course, plays for the Broncos. And 40 yards later, he's in the end zone. Remember any of this? Rick slowly closed his eyes and said, No. Don't try too hard. Both teams punt, then the Broncos fumble. With 6 minutes to go, on a 3rd and 8, you check off at the line and throw to Bryce on a hook, but the ball is high and is picked off by somebody in a white jersey. Can't recall his name, but he sure can run. All the way. 17-14. The place is getting tense. 80,000 plus. A few minutes earlier, they were celebrating. First Super Bowl ever, all that jazz. Broncos kick off. Browns run the ball 3 times because Cooley ain't about to send in a pass play. And so the Browns punt. Or try to. Snap gets fumbled. Broncos get the ball on the Browns' 34-yard line. Which is no problem whatsoever because in 3 plays, the Browns' defense, which is really, really pissed at this point, stuffs them for 15 yards out of field goal range. Broncos punt, you take over at your own 6, and for the next 4 minutes, manage to cram the ball into the middle of the defensive line. The drive stalls at midfield, 3rd and 10, 40 seconds to go. Browns are afraid to pass and even more afraid to punt. I don't know what Cooley sends in, but you check off again. Fire a missile to the right sideline for Bryce, who's wide open, right on target. Rick tried to sit up and for a moment forgot about his injuries.
I still don't remember.
Right on target, but much too hard. It hits Bryce in the chest, bounces up, and Goodson grabs it, gallops to the promised land. Browns lose, 21-17. You're on the ground, almost sawed in half. They put you on a stretcher, and as they roll you off the field, half the crowd is booing, and the other half is cheering wildly. Quite a noise. Never heard anything like it. A couple of drunks jump from the stands and rush the stretcher. They would have killed you, but security steps in. A nice brawl ensues, and it, too, is all over the talk shows. Rick was slumped over, low in the bed, lower than ever, with his eyes closed and his breathing quite labored. The headaches were back, along with the sharp pains in the neck and along the spine. Where were the drugs? Sorry, kid, Arnie said. The room was nicer in the darkness, so Arnie closed the blinds and reassumed his position in the chair with his newspaper. His client appeared to be dead. The doctors were ready to release him, but Arnie had argued strongly that he needed a few more days of rest and protection. The Browns were paying for the security guards, and they were not happy about it. The team was also covering the medicals, and it wouldn't be long before they complained. And Arnie was fed up, too. Rick's career, if you could call it that, was over. Arnie got 5%, and 5% of Rick's salary wasn't enough to cover expenses. Are you awake, Rick?
Yes, he said, with his eyes still closed. Listen to me, okay? I'm listening. The hardest part of my job is telling a player that it's time to quit. You've played all your life, it's all you know, all you dream about. No one is ever ready to quit. But Rick, old buddy, it's time to call it quits. There are no options.
I'm 28 years old, Arnie, Rick said with his eyes open, very sad eyes.
What do you suggest I do?
A lot of guys go into coaching. And real estate, you were smart, you got your degree.
My degree is in phys ed, Arnie. That means I can get a job teaching volleyball to 6th graders for $40,000 a year. I'm not ready for that.
Arnie stood and walked around the end of the bed, as if deep in thought.
Why don't you go home, get some rest, and think about it?
Home? Where is home? I've lived in so many different places.
Home is Iowa, Rick. They still love you there.
And they really love you in Denver, Arnie thought, but wisely kept it to himself. The idea of being seen on the streets of Davenport, Iowa, terrified Rick, and he let out a soft groan. The town was probably humiliated by the play of its native son. Ouch. He thought of his poor parents and closed his eyes. Arnie glanced at his watch, then for some reason finally noticed that there were no get-well cards or flowers in the room. The nurses told him that no friends had stopped by, no family, no teammates, no one even remotely connected to the Cleveland Browns. I gotta run, kid. I'll drop by tomorrow. Walking out, he nonchalantly tossed the newspaper on Rick's bed. As soon as the door closed behind him, Rick grabbed it, and soon wished he had not. The police estimated a crowd of 50 had staged a rowdy demonstration outside the hospital. Things got ugly when a TV news crew showed up and began filming. A window was smashed, and a few of the drunker fans stormed the ER check-in, supposedly looking for Rick Dockery. 8 were arrested. A large photo, front page beneath the fold, captured the crowd before the arrests. 2 crude signs could be read clearly. Pull the plug now, and legalize euthanasia. It got worse. The Post had a notorious sports writer named Charlie Cray, a nasty hack whose specialty was attack journalism. Just clever enough to be credible, Cray was widely read because he delighted in the missteps and foibles of professional athletes who earned millions, yet were not perfect. He was an expert on everything and never missed a chance for a cheap shot. His Tuesday column, Front Page Sports, began with the headline, Could Dockery Top All-Time GOAT List? Knowing Cray, there was no doubt Rick Dockery would top the list. The column, well-researched and savagely written, was structured around Cray's opinions about the greatest individual chokes, screw-ups, and collapses in the history of sports. There was Bill Buckner's booted ground ball in the 86 World Series, Jackie Smith's dropped TD pass in Super Bowl 13, and so on. But, as Cray screamed at his readers, those were only single plays. Mr. Dockery, on the other hand, managed 3, count them, 3 horrible passes in only 11 minutes. Clearly, therefore, Rick Dockery is the unquestioned greatest GOAT in the history of professional sports. The verdict was undisputed, and Cray challenged anyone to argue with him. Rick flung the newspaper against the wall and called for another pill. In the darkness, alone with the door closed, he waited for the drug to work its magic, to knock him out clean, then, hopefully, to take him away forever. He slipped lower in the bed, pulled the sheet over his head, and began crying. Chapter 2. It was snowing, and Arnie was tired of Cleveland. He was at the airport, waiting for a flight to Las Vegas, his home. And against his better judgment, he made a call to a lesser vice president of the Arizona Cardinals. At the moment, and not including Rick Dockery, Arnie had 7 players in the NFL and 4 in Canada. He was, if he could be forced to admit it, a mid-list agent who, of course, had bigger ambitions. Making phone calls for Rick Dockery was not going to help his credibility. Rick was arguably the most talked-about player in the country at that dismal moment, but it wasn't the kind of buzz that Arnie needed. The vice president was polite, but brief, and couldn't wait to get off the phone. Arnie went to a bar, got a drink, and managed to find a seat far away from any television, since the only story still raging in Cleveland was the 3 interceptions by a quarterback no one even knew was on the team. The Browns had rolled through the season with a sputtering offense, but a bruising defense, one that shattered records for yielding so few yards and points. They lost only once. And with each win, a city starved for a Super Bowl became more and more enthralled with their old lovable losers. Suddenly, in one quick season, the Browns were the Slayers. Had they won the previous Sunday, their Super Bowl opponent would be the Minnesota Vikings, a team they shut out and routed back in November. The entire city could taste the sweetness of a championship. It all vanished in 11 horrifying minutes. Arnie ordered a second drink. 2 salesmen at the next table were getting drunk and relishing the Browns' collapse. They were from Detroit. The hottest story of the day had been the firing of the Browns' general manager, Clyde Wacker, a man who had been hailed as a genius as recently as the preceding Saturday, but was now the perfect scapegoat. Someone had to be fired, and not just Rick Dockery. When it was finally determined that Wacker had signed Dockery off waivers back in October, the owner fired him. The execution was public. Big press conference, lots of frowns, and promises to run a tighter ship, etc. The Browns would be back. Arnie met Rick during his senior year at Iowa, at the end of a season that had begun with much promise, but was fading into a third-tier bowl game. Rick started at quarterback his last two seasons, and he seemed well-suited for a drop-back, open-style offense so rare in the Big Ten. At times he was brilliant, reading defenses, coolly checking off at the line, firing the ball with incredible velocity. His arm was amazing, undoubtedly the best in the upcoming draft. He could throw long and hard with a lightning-quick release. But he was too erratic to be trusted, and when Buffalo picked him in the last round, it should have been a clear sign that he needed to pursue a master's degree or a stockbroker's license. Instead, he went to Toronto for two miserable seasons, then began bouncing around the NFL. With a great arm, Rick was just barely good enough to make a roster. Every team needs a third-string quarterback. In tryouts, and there had been many, he'd often dazzled coaches with his arm. Arnie watched one day in Kansas City when Rick threw a football 80 yards, then a few minutes later clocked a bullet at 90 miles an hour. But Arnie knew what most coaches now strongly suspected. Rick, for a football player, was afraid of contact. Not the incidental contact, not the quick and harmless tackle of a scrambling quarterback. Rick, with good reason, feared the rushing tackles and the blitzing linebackers. There is a moment or two in every game when a quarterback has a receiver open, a split second to throw the ball, and a massive, roaring lineman charging the pocket unblocked. The quarterback has a choice. He can grit his teeth, sacrifice his body, put his team first, throw the damn ball, make the play, and get crushed, or he can tuck it and run and pray he lives for another play. Rick, as long as Arnie had watched him play, had never, not once, put the team first. At the first hint of a sack, Rick flinched and ran frantically for the sideline. And with a propensity for concussions, Arnie really couldn't blame him. He called a nephew of the owner of the Rams, who answered the phone with an icy, "I hope this is not about Dockery." "Well, yes, it is," Arnie managed to say. "The answer is hell no." Since Sunday, Arnie had spoken with about half of the NFL teams. The response from the Rams was pretty typical. Rick had no idea how completely his sad little career had been terminated. Watching a monitor on the wall, Arnie saw his flight get delayed. "One more call," he vowed. "One more effort to find Rick a job, and then he would move on to his other players." The clients were from Portland, and though his last name was Webb, and she was as pale as a Swede, they both claimed Italian blood, and were keen to see the old country where it all began. Each spoke about 6 words of the language, and spoke them badly. Sam suspected they had picked up a travel book at the airport, and memorized a few of the basics over the Atlantic. On their previous trip to Italy, their driver-guide had been a native with dreadful English, and so they had insisted on an American this time around, a good Yank, who could arrange meals and find tickets. After 2 days together, Sam was ready to ship them back to Portland. Sam was neither a driver nor a guide. He was, however, very much an American, and since his primary job paid little, he moonlighted occasionally when his countrymen passed through and needed someone to hold their hands. He waited outside in the car while they had a very long dinner at Lazzaro's, an old trattoria in the center of the city. It was cold and snowing lightly, and as he sipped strong coffee, his thoughts returned to his roster, as they always did. His cell phone startled him. The call was from the United States. He said hello. "Sam Russo, please," came a crisp greeting. "This is Sam. Coach Russo. Yes, that's me." The caller identified himself as Arnie something or other, said he was an agent of some sort, and claimed to have been a manager on the 1988 Bucknell football team, a few years after Sam played there. Since they both went to Bucknell, they quickly found common ground, and after a few minutes of "do you know so-and-so," they were friendly. For Sam, it was nice to chat with someone from his old school, albeit a total stranger, and it was rare that he got calls from agents. Arnie finally got to the point. "Sure, I watched the playoffs," Sam said. "Well, I represent Rick Dockery, and, well, the Browns let him go," Arnie said. No surprise there, Sam thought, but kept listening. "And he's looking around, considering his options. I heard the rumor that you need a quarterback." Sam almost dropped the phone. A real NFL quarterback playing in Parma? "It's not a rumor," he said.
My quarterback quit last week and took a coaching job somewhere in upstate New York. We'd love to have Dockery. Is he okay? Physically, I mean?
Sure, just bruised a little, but he's ready to go.
And he wants to play in Italy?
Maybe. We haven't discussed it yet. You know, he's still in the hospital. But we're looking at all the possibilities. Frankly, he needs a change of scenery.
Do you know the game over here? Sam asked nervously.
It's good football, but it's a far cry from the NFL and the Big Ten. I mean, these guys are not professionals in the true sense of the word.
What level?
I don't know. Tough to say.
Ever hear of a school called Washington and Lee down in Virginia? A nice school, good football, Division III.
Sure.
They came over last year during spring break, and we scrimmaged them a couple times. Pretty even matchup.
Division III, huh? Arnie said, his voice losing some steam.
But then, Rick needed a softer game, another concussion, and he might indeed suffer the brain damage so often joked about. Truthfully, Arnie didn't care. Just another phone call or two, and Rick Dockery was history.
Look, Arnie, Sam began earnestly.
Time for the truth.
It's a club sport over here, or maybe a notch above that. Each team in the Series A gets 3 American players, and they usually get meal money, maybe some rent. The quarterbacks are typically American, and they get a small salary. The rest of the roster is a bunch of tough Italians who play because they love football. If they're lucky and the owner is in a good mood, they might get pizza and beer after the game. We play an 8-game schedule with playoffs, then a chance for the Italian Super Bowl. Our field is old, but nice, well-maintained, seats about 3,000, and for a big game, we might fill it. We have corporate sponsors, cool uniforms, but no TV contract, and no real money to speak of. We're smack in the middle of the world of soccer, so our football has more of a cult following.
How did you get there?
I love Italy. My grandparents emigrated from this region, settled in Baltimore, where I grew up. But I have lots of cousins around here. My wife is Italian and so on. It's a delightful place to live. Can't make any money coaching American football, but we're having fun.
So the coaches get paid?
Yes, you could say that. Any other NFL rejects? Occasionally one passes through, some lost soul still dreaming of a Super Bowl ring, but the Americans are usually small college players who love the game and have a sense of adventure.
How much can you pay my man?
Let me check with the owner.
Do that, and I'll check with my client.
They signed off after another Bucknell story, and Sam returned to his coffee.
An NFL quarterback playing football in Italy? It was hard to imagine, though not without precedent.
The Bologna Warriors were in the Italian Super Bowl 2 years earlier with a 40-year-old quarterback who'd once played briefly for Oakland. He quit after 2 seasons and went to Canada. Sam turned the car heater down a notch and replayed the final minutes of the Browns-Broncos game. Never in his memory had he watched one player so completely engineer a defeat and lose a game that was so clearly won. He himself had almost cheered when Dockery was carried off the field. Nevertheless, the idea of coaching him in Parma was intriguing.
Chapter 3.
Though the packing and leaving was somewhat of a ritual, the departure from Cleveland was a bit more stressful than usual. Someone found out that he had leased a condo on the 7th floor of a glass building near the lake, and there were 2 shaggy reporter types with cameras loitering near the guardhouse when Rick wheeled through in his black Tahoe. He parked underground and hurried up the elevator. The phone in the kitchen was ringing when he unlocked the door. A pleasant voicemail was left behind by none other than Charlie Cray. 3 hours later, the SUV was packed with clothes and golf clubs and a stereo. 13 trips, he counted them, up and down the elevator, and his neck and shoulders were killing him. His head ached and throbbed, and the painkillers did little to help. He wasn't supposed to drive while drugged, but Rick was driving. Rick was leaving, running away from the lease on the condo and the rented furniture therein, fleeing Cleveland and the Browns and their awful fans, scampering away to somewhere. He wasn't quite sure where. Wisely, he had signed only a 6-month lease on the condo. Since college, he'd lived a life of short leases and rented furniture and learned not to accumulate too many things. He fought the downtown traffic and managed to glance in the mirror for one last look at the Cleveland skyline. Good riddance. He was thrilled to be leaving. He vowed to never return, unless, of course, he was playing against the Browns. But then he'd promised himself that he would not think about the future. Not for another week, anyway. As he raced through the suburbs,
He admitted to himself that Cleveland was undoubtedly happier with his departure than he was. He was drifting west, in the general direction of Iowa, not with any enthusiasm, because he was not excited about going home. He'd called his parents once from the hospital. His mother asked about his head and begged him to stop playing. His father asked him what the hell he was thinking when he threw that last pass. "How are things in Davenport?" Rick had finally asked his father. Both knew what he was after. He wasn't curious about the local economy. "Not too good," his father said. A weather bulletin caught his attention. Heavy snow to the west, a blizzard in Iowa, and Rick happily turned left and headed south. An hour later, his cell phone buzzed. It was Arnie, in Vegas, sounding much happier.
"Where are you, kid?" he asked.
"I'm out of Cleveland."
"Thank God. Going home?"
"Nah, I'm just driving, going south. Maybe I'll go to Florida and play some golf."
"Great idea. How's your head?"
"Fine."
"Any additional brain damage?"
Arnie asked with a fake laugh. It was a punchline Rick had heard at least 100 times.
"Severe damage," he said.
"Look, kid, I'm onto something here. A spot on a roster. Guaranteed starting position. Gorgeous cheerleaders. Wanna hear it?"
Rick repeated it slowly, certain that he had misunderstood the details. The Vicodin was soaking a few areas of his tender brain.
Okay, he finally said.
"I just talked to the head coach of the Panthers, and they will offer a contract right now, on the spot, no questions asked. It's not a lot of money, but it's a job. You'll still be the quarterback. The starting quarterback. A done deal. It's all you, baby."
"The Panthers?"
"You got it. The Parma Panthers."
There was a long pause as Rick struggled with geography. Obviously, it was some minor league outfit, some independent bush league so far from the NFL that it was a joke. Surely it wasn't arena football. Arnie knew better than to think about that. But he couldn't place Parma.
"Did you say Carolina Panthers, Arnie?"
"Listen to me, Rick. Parma Panthers."
There was a Parma in the Cleveland suburbs. It was all very confusing.
"Okay, Arnie, pardon the brain damage, but why don't you tell me exactly where Parma is?"
"It's in northern Italy, about an hour from Milan."
"Where's Milan?"
"It's in northern Italy, too. I'll buy you an atlas. Anyway,
football is soccer over there, Arnie. Wrong sport."
"Listen to me. They have some well-established leagues in Europe. It's big in Germany, Austria, Italy. It could be fun. Where's your sense of adventure?"
Rick's head began throbbing, and he needed another pill. But he was practically stoned anyway, and a DUI was the last thing he needed. The cop would probably look at his license and go for the handcuffs, or maybe even his nightstick.
"I don't think so," he said.
"You should do it, Rick. Take a year off. Go play in Europe. Let the dust settle over here. I gotta tell you, kid, I don't mind making phone calls, but the timing is lousy. Really lousy."
"I don't want to hear it, Arnie. Look, let's talk later. My head is killing me."
"Sure, kid, sleep on it, but we need to move fast. The team in Parma is looking for a quarterback. Their season starts soon, and they're desperate. I mean, not desperate to sign just anybody, but..."
"Got it, Arnie. Later."
"You've heard of Parmesan cheese?"
"Sure."
"That's where they make it. In Parma. Get it?"
"If I wanted cheese, I'd go to Green Bay," Rick said, and thought himself clever in spite of the drugs.
"I called the Packers, but they haven't called back."
"I don't want to hear it."
Near Mansfield, he settled into a booth in the restaurant of a crowded truck stop and ordered French fries and a Coke. The words on the menu were slightly blurred, but he took another pill anyway because of the pain at the top of his spine. In the hospital, once the television was working, he'd made the mistake of finally watching the highlights on ESPN. He cringed and even flinched at the sight of his own body getting hit so hard and crumbling to the ground in a heap. Two truckers at a nearby table began glancing at him.
Oh, great. Why didn't I wear a cap and some sunglasses?
They whispered and pointed, and before long, others were looking, even glaring at him. Rick wanted to leave, but the Vicodin said no, take it easy for a while. He ordered another plate of French fries and tried to call his parents. They were either out or ignoring him. He called a college friend in Boca to make sure he had a place to stay for a few days. The truckers were laughing about something. He tried to ignore them.
On a white paper napkin, he began scribbling numbers. The Browns owed him $50,000 for the playoffs. Surely the team would pay him. He had about $40,000 in the bank in Davenport. Due to his nomadic career, he had not purchased any real estate. The SUV was being leased, $700 a month. There were no other assets. He studied the numbers, and his best guess was that he could escape with about $80,000. To leave the game with three concussions and $80,000 was not as bad as it seemed. The average NFL running back lasted 3 years, retired with all manner of leg injuries, and owed about $500,000. Rick's financial problems came from disastrous investments. He and a teammate from Iowa had tried to corner the car wash market in Des Moines. Lawsuits had followed, and his name was still on bank loans. He owned one-third of a Mexican restaurant in Fort Worth, and the other two owners, former friends, were screaming for more capital. The last time he ate there, the burritos made him sick. With Arnie's help, he had managed to avoid bankruptcy. The headlines would have been brutal. But the debts had piled up. A rather large trucker with an amazing beer belly drew near, stopped, and sneered at Rick. He was the whole package. Thick sideburns, trucker cap, toothpick dangling from his lips.
"You're Dockery, aren't you?"
For a split second, Rick thought of denying it. Then he decided to simply ignore him.
"You suck, you know that?"
the trucker said loudly, and for the benefit of his audience.
"You sucked at Iowa, and you still suck."
There was heavy laughter in the background as the others joined in. One shot to the beer belly and the dude would be on the floor, squealing. And the fact that Rick even thought about it made him sad. The headlines, why was he so concerned with the headlines? Would be great. Dockery brawls with truckers. And, of course, everyone who read the story would be pulling for the truckers. Charlie Cray would have a field day. Rick smiled at his napkin and bit his tongue.
"Why don't you move to Denver? Bet they love you there."
Even more laughter. Rick added some meaningless numbers to his tally and pretended as if he heard nothing. Finally, the trucker moved on, with quite a swagger now. It's not every day that you get the chance to berate an NFL quarterback. He took I-71 south to Columbus, home of the Buckeyes. There, not too many years ago, in front of 100,000 fans, on a gorgeous autumn afternoon, he'd thrown 4 touchdown passes and picked the defense apart like a surgeon. Big Ten Player of the Week. More honors would certainly follow. The future was so bright it blinded him. 3 hours later, he stopped for gas and saw a new motel next door. He'd driven enough. He fell on the bed and planned to sleep for days when his cell phone rang. Arnie said,
"Where are you now?"
"I don't know. London?"
"What? Where?"
"London, Kentucky, Arnie."
"Let's talk about Parma,"
Arnie said, crisp and businesslike. Something was up.
I thought we agreed to do that later.
Rick pinched his nose and slowly stretched his legs.
"This is later. They need a decision."
"Okay, give me the details."
"They'll pay 3,000 euros a month for 5 months, plus an apartment and a car."
"What's a euro?"
"That's the currency in Europe." "Hello? It's worth about a third more than the dollar these days."
"So how much, Arnie? What's the offer?"
"About 4,000 bucks a month."
The numbers registered quickly because there were so few of them.
"The quarterback makes 20,000? What does a lineman make?"
"Who cares? You're not a lineman."
"Just curious, why are you so testy?"
"Because I'm spending too much time on this, Rick. I've got other deals to negotiate. You know how hectic it gets in the postseason."
"Are you unloading me, Arnie?"
"Of course not. It's just that I really think you should go abroad for a while. Recharge your batteries, you know? Let the old brain heal. Give me some time stateside to assess the damage."
The damage. Rick tried to sit up, but nothing cooperated. Every bone and muscle from the waist up was damaged. If Collins hadn't missed the block, Rick wouldn't have been crushed. Linemen. Love 'em and hate 'em. He wanted linemen.
"How much do the linemen make?"
"Nothing. The linemen are Italians, and they play because they love football."
And the agents must starve to death over there, Rick thought to himself. He breathed deeply and tried to remember the last player he knew who played just for the love of the game.
20,000, Rick mumbled.
"Which is 20 more than you're currently making," Arnie reminded him, rather cruelly.
"Thanks, Arnie. I can always count on you."
"Look, kid, take a year off. Go see Europe. Give me some time.
How good is the football?
Who cares? You'll be the star. All of the quarterbacks are Americans, but there's small college types who didn't get near the draft. The Panthers are thrilled that you're even considering the deal.
Someone was thrilled to get him. What a pleasant idea. But what would he tell his family and friends?
What friends? He had heard from exactly two old buddies in the past week. After a pause, Arnie cleared his throat and said, "There's something else." From the tone, it could not be good.
"I'm listening."
"What time did you leave the hospital today?"
I don't remember. Maybe around 9.
"Well, you must have passed him in the hallway."
"Who?"
"An investigator. Your cheerleader friend is back, Rick. Quite pregnant. And now she's got lawyers, some real sleazeballs who want to make some noise, get their mugs in the paper. They're calling here with all sorts of demands."
"Which cheerleader?" Rick asked as new waves of pain swept through his shoulders and neck.
"Tiffany something or other?"
"There's no way, Arnie. She slept with half the Browns. Why is she coming after me?"
"Did you sleep with her?"
"Of course, but it was my turn. If she's going to have a million-dollar baby, why is she accusing me?"
An excellent question from the lowest paid member of the team. Arnie had made the same point when arguing with Tiffany's lawyers.
"Is it possible that you might be the daddy?"
"Absolutely not. I was careful. You had to be." "Well, she can't go public until she serves you with the papers. And if she can't find you, then she can't serve you."
Rick knew all this. He'd been served before.
"I'll hide in Florida for a while. They can't find me down there."
"Don't bet on it. These lawyers are pretty aggressive.
They want some publicity. There are ways to track people."
A pause, then the clincher.
"But, pal, they can't serve you in Italy."
"I've never been to Italy."
"Then it's time to go."
"Let me sleep on it."
"Sure."
Rick dozed off quickly and slept hard for 10 minutes when a nightmare jolted him from his nap. Credit cards leave a trail. Gas stations, motels, truck stops. Every place was connected to a vast web of electronic information that zipped around the world in a split second. And surely some geek with a high-powered computer could tap in here and there and for a nice fee pick up the trail and send in the bloodhounds with a copy of Tiffany's paternity suit. More headlines, more legal troubles. He grabbed his unpacked bag and fled the motel. He drove another hour, very much under the influence, and found a dump with cheap rooms for cash, by the hour or by the night. He fell onto the dusty bed and was soon sound asleep, snoring loudly, and dreaming of leaning towers and Roman ruins.
Chapter 4 Coach Russo read the Gazzetta di Parma while he waited patiently on a hard plastic chair inside the Parma train station. He hated to admit that he was a little nervous. He and his new quarterback had chatted once by phone while he, the quarterback, was on a golf course somewhere in Florida, and the conversation left something to be desired. Dockery was reluctant to play for Parma, though the idea of living abroad for a few months was certainly appealing. Dockery seemed reluctant to play anywhere. The greatest goat theme had spread, and he was still the butt of many jokes. He was a football player and needed to play, yet he wasn't sure he wanted to see another football. Dockery said he didn't speak a word of Italian, but had studied Spanish in the 10th grade. Great, thought Russo. No problem. Sam had never coached a pro quarterback. His last one had played sparingly at the University of Delaware. How would Dockery fit? The team was excited to have such a talent, but would they accept him? Would his attitude poison the locker room? Would he be coachable? The Eurostar from Milan coasted into the station, on time as always. Doors snapped open, passengers spilled out. It was mid-March, and most were clad in dark, heavy coats, still bundled from the winter and waiting for warmer weather. Then there was Dockery, fresh from South Florida with a ridiculous tan and dressed for summer drinks at the country club, cream-colored linen sports coat, lemon shirt with a tropical motif, white slacks that stopped at bronze, sockless ankles, thin crocodile loafers, more maroon than brown. He was wrestling with two perfectly matched and monstrous pieces of luggage on wheels, and his task was made almost impossible because he had slung over his back a bulky set of golf clubs. The quarterback had arrived. Sam watched the struggle and knew instantly that Dockery had never been on a train before.
He finally walked over and said, "Rick, I'm Sam Russo." A half smile as he jolted things upward and managed to slide the golf clubs up his back.
"Hey, coach," he said.
"Welcome to Parma. Let me give you a hand." Sam grabbed one suitcase and they began rolling through the station.
"Thanks. It's pretty cold here."
"Colder than Florida. How was your flight?"
"Fine."
"Play a lot of golf, do you?"
"Sure. When does it get warm?"
"A month or so."
"A lot of golf courses around here?"
"No, I've never seen one." They were outside now, stopping at Sam's boxy little Honda.
"This is it?"
Rick asked as he glanced around and noticed all of the other very small cars. "Throw those in the back seat," Sam said. He popped the trunk and manhandled a suitcase into the tight space. There was no room for the other. It went into the rear seat, on top of the clubs.
"Good thing I didn't pack more," Rick mumbled.
They got in. At 6'2", Rick's knees hit the dashboard. His seat refused to slide back because of the golf clubs.
"Pretty small cars over here, huh?" he observed.
"You got it. Gas is $1.20 a liter."
"How much a gallon?"
"They don't use gallons. They use liters." Sam shifted gears, and they moved away from the station.
"Okay, about how much a gallon?" Rick went on.
"Well, a liter is roughly a quart." Rick pondered this as he gazed blankly out his window at the buildings along Strada Garibaldi.
"Okay, how many quarts in a gallon?"
"Where'd you go to college?"
"Where'd you go?"
"Bucknell."
"Never heard of it. They play football?"
"Sure, small stuff. Nothing like the Big Ten. 4 quarts in a gallon, so a gallon here is about $5.
"These buildings are really old," Rick said.
"They don't call it the old country for nothing. What was your major in college?"
"Phys ed, cheerleaders."
"Study much history?"
"Hated history. Why?"
"Parma goes back 2,000 years and has an interesting history."
"Parma," Rick said as he exhaled and managed to slide down an inch or two, as if the very mention of the place meant defeat.
He fished through a coat pocket and found his cell phone, but didn't open it.
"What the hell am I doing in Parma, Italy?"
he asked, though it was more of a statement. Sam figured no response was best, so he decided to become a guide. "This is the downtown, the oldest section. First time in Italy?"
"Yep. What's that?"
"It's called Palazzo della Pelota. Started 400 years ago. Never finished. Then bombed to hell and back by the Allies in 1944.
"We bombed Parma?"
"We bombed everything, even Rome. But we laid off the Vatican. The Italians, as you might recall, had a leader named Mussolini, who cut a deal with Hitler. Not a good move, though the Italians never warmed up to the notion of war. They're much better at food, wine, sports cars, fashion, sex."
"Maybe I'll like this place."
"You will. And they love opera. To the right there is the Teatro Reggio, the famous opera house. Ever see an opera?"
"Oh, yeah, sure. We were raised on the stuff in Iowa.
Spent most of my childhood at the opera."
"Are you kidding?
Why would I go to an opera?" "There's the Duomo," Sam said.
"The what?"
"Duomo, cathedral. Think of dome, you know, like Superdome, Carrier Dome." Rick did not respond, but instead went silent for a moment, as if the memory of domes and stadiums and their related games made him uncomfortable. They were in the center of Parma, with pedestrians scurrying about and cars bumper to bumper. Sam finally continued. "Most Italian cities are sort of configured around a central square called a piazza. This is Piazza Garibaldi. Lots of shops and cafes and foot traffic. The Italians spend a lot of time sitting at the outdoor cafes, sipping espresso and reading. Not a bad habit."
"I don't do coffee."
"It's time to start."
"What do these Italians think of Americans?"
"They like us, I guess. Not that they dwell on the subject. If they stop and think about it, they probably dislike our government, but generally they couldn't care less. They are crazy about our culture."
"Even football?"
"To some degree. There's a great little bar over there. You want something to drink?"
"No, it's too early."
"Not alcohol. A bar here is like a small pub or coffee shop, a gathering place."
"I'll pass."
"Anyway, the center of the city is where the action is. Your apartment is just a few streets over."
"Can't wait.
Mind if I make a call?"
"Prego."
"What?" "Prego. It means go right ahead." Rick punched the numbers while Sam worked his car through the late afternoon traffic. When Rick glanced out his window, Sam quickly pushed a button on the radio and low-volume opera rose in the background. Whoever Rick needed to chat with was unavailable. No voicemail was left by the quarterback. Phone slapped shut, returned to pocket. Probably his agent, thought Sam. Maybe a girlfriend.
You got a girl?
Sam asked.
No one in particular. Lots of NFL groupies, but they're dumb as rocks.
You?
Married for 11 years. No kids.
They crossed a bridge called the Ponte Verde.
This is the Parma River. It divides the city.
Lovely.
Ahead of us is the Parco Ducale, the largest park in the city. It's quite beautiful. Italians are big on parks and landscaping and such.
It's pretty.
Glad you approve. It's a great place to walk, take a girl, read a book, lie in the sun.
Never spent much time in parks.
What a surprise.
They looped around, recrossed the river, and were soon darting through narrow one-way streets.
You've now seen most of downtown Parma, Sam said.
Nice.
A few blocks south of the park, they turned onto a winding street, Via Lenati.
There, Sam said, pointing to a long row of four-story buildings, each painted a different color.
The second one, sort of a gold color. Apartments on the third floor. It's a nice part of town. Signor Bruncardo, the gent who owns the team, also owns a few buildings. That's why you get to live downtown. It's more expensive here.
And these guys really play for free?
Rick said, mulling something that had stuck from a prior conversation.
The Americans get paid, you and two others. Only three this year. No one makes as much as you.
Yes, the Italians play for the sport of it. And the post-game pizza.
A pause. Then he added, you're gonna love these guys.
It was his first effort at bolstering team spirit. If the quarterback wasn't happy, then there would be many problems.
He somehow wedged his Honda into a space half its size, and they loaded up the luggage and golf clubs.
There was no elevator, but the stairwell was wider than normal. The apartment was furnished and had three rooms, a bedroom, a den, a small kitchen. Because his new quarterback was coming from the NFL, Signor Brancardo had sprung for new paint, rugs, curtains, and den furniture. There was even some splashy contemporary art on the walls.
Not bad, Rick said, and Russo was relieved. He knew the realities of urban real estate in Italy. Most of the apartments were small and old and expensive. If the quarterback was disappointed, then Signor Brancardo would be too. Things would get complicated.
On the market, it would be 2,000 euros a month, Sam said, trying to impress.
Rick was carefully placing his golf clubs on the sofa.
Nice place, he said.
He couldn't count the number of apartments he'd passed through in the last 6 years. The constant moving, often in a hurry, had deadened any appreciation of square footage, decor, and furnishings.
Why don't you change clothes and I'll meet you downstairs, Sam said.
Rick glanced down at his white slacks and brown ankles and almost said, oh, I'm fine. But then he took the hint and said,
sure. Give me 5 minutes.
There's a cafe 2 blocks down on the right, Sam said. I'll be at a table outside having a coffee.
Sure, coach.
Sam ordered coffee and opened his newspaper. It was damp, and the sun had dipped behind the buildings. The Americans always went through a brief period of culture shock. The language, cars, narrow streets, smaller lodgings, the confinement of the cities. It was overwhelming, especially to the middle and lower class guys who'd traveled little. In his 5 years as coach of the Parma Panthers, Sam had met exactly one American player who'd ever been to Italy before joining the team. Two of Italy's national treasures usually warmed them up, food and women. Coach Russo did not meddle with the latter, but he knew the power of Italian cooking. Mr. Dockery was facing a 4-hour dinner and had no idea what was coming. 10 minutes later, he arrived, cell phone in hand, of course, and looked much better. Navy blazer, faded jeans, dark socks and shoes.
Coffee? Sam asked.
Just a Coke.
Sam talked to the waiter.
So you speak the lingo, huh?
Rick said, stuffing the phone in a pocket.
I've lived here for 5 years. My wife is Italian. I told you that.
Do the other Yanks pick up the language?
A few words, especially items on a menu.
Just curious as to how I'm supposed to call the plays in the huddle?
We do it in English. Sometimes the Italians get the plays, sometimes they don't.
Just like in college, Rick said, and they both laughed.
He gulped his Coke, then said,
me, I'm not bothering with the language.
too much trouble. When I played in Canada, there was a lot of French. Didn't slow us down. Everyone spoke English, too. Not everyone speaks English here, I can assure you of that. Yes, but everyone speaks American Express and greenbacks. Maybe. It's not a bad idea to study the language. Life's easier, and your teammates will love you.
Love? Did you say love? I haven't loved a teammate since I was in college.
This is like college. A big fraternity with guys who like to put on the gear, brawl for a couple of hours, then go drink beer. If they accept you, and I'm sure they will, then they'll kill for you.
Do they know about, you know, my last game?
I haven't asked them, but I'm sure some do. They love football and watch a lot of games, but don't worry, Rick. They're delighted you're here. These guys have never won the Italian Super Bowl, and they're convinced this is the year. Three signorinas walked by and required their attention. When they were out of sight, Rick gazed at the street and seemed lost in another world. Sam liked him and felt sorry for him. He had endured an avalanche of public ridicule never before seen in professional football, and here he was in Parma, alone and confused, and running. Parma was where he belonged, at least for now.
"You want to go see the field?" Sam asked.
"Sure, coach."
As they walked away, Sam pointed down another street. "There's a men's store down there. Great clothes. You should check it out."
"I brought plenty."
"Like I said, you should check it out. Italians are very stylish, and they'll watch you carefully, both men and women. You can never be overdressed here."
"Language, clothes. Anything else, coach?"
"Yes, a bit of advice. Try to enjoy yourself here. It's a wonderful old town, and you're here for such a short time."
"Sure, coach."
Chapter 5. The Stadio Lanfranchi is in the northwest corner of Parma, still in the city proper, but away from the ancient buildings and narrow streets. It's a rugby pitch, home to two professional teams and leased to the Panthers for football. It has canopy-covered grandstands on both sides, a press box, and a playing surface of natural grass that is well-maintained in spite of the heavy traffic. Soccer is played at the much larger Stadio Tardini, a mile away in the southeast section of the city, and there larger crowds gather to celebrate Italy's modern-day reason to exist. There's not much to cheer about, though. The lowly Parma team barely clings to its place in the prestigious Series A of Italian soccer. The team still draws its faithful, though. About 30,000 long-suffering fans show up with Cubs-like devotion year after year, game after game. That's about 29,000 more than generally show up for Panthers games at Stadio Lanfranchi. It has seating for 3,000, but rarely sells out. Actually, there's nothing to sell. Admission is free. Rick Dockery walked slowly across midfield as long shadows fell, hands crammed in jeans pockets, the aimless stroll of a man in another world. Occasionally, he stopped and pressed hard with a loafer to check the turf. He had not stepped onto a field, or a pitch, or whatever the hell it was, since that last day in Cleveland. Sam sat five rows up on the home side, watching his quarterback, and wondering what he was thinking. Rick was thinking about a training camp one summer not too long ago. A brief but brutal ordeal with one of the pro teams. He couldn't remember exactly which. Camp that summer had been at a small college with a field similar to the one he was now inspecting. A Division III school. A tiny college with the obligatory rustic dorms and cafeteria and cramped locker rooms, the type of place some NFL teams choose to make training as tough and austere as possible. Andy was thinking about high school. Back at Davenport South, he had played every game in front of more people, home and away. He lost in the state finals his junior year in front of 11,000. Small maybe by Texas standards, but still a heck of a crowd for Iowa high school football. At the moment, though, Davenport South was far away, as were many things that once seemed important. He stopped in the end zone and studied the goalposts. Odd ones. Two tall posts, painted blue and yellow, anchored in the ground and wrapped with green padding that advertised Heineken. Rugby. He climbed the steps and sat next to his coach, who said,
"What do you think?" "Nice field, but you're missing a few yards."
10, to be exact. The goalposts are 110 yards apart, but we need 20 for the two end zones. So we play on what's left, 90 yards. Most of the fields we play on are meant for rugby, so we have to make do."
Rick grunted and smiled.
"Whatever."
It's a long way from Brown Stadium in Cleveland, Sam said.
Thank God for that. I never liked Cleveland, the city, the fans, the team, and I hate it.